You are listening to a session recorded live at the American Association for the Advancement of Science's 2012 annual meeting, held February 16th through the 20th in Vancouver, British Columbia. Now to our session.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you for being here. We have just an outstanding set of three talks followed by a half hour or so of discussion. We hope you'll be thoroughly engaged in that discussion. The session has its origins with a little group that meets a couple times a year to help represent the each country, I guess, has a representative group like this for the International Union of Geodesy and Geophysics, and three of us here, Esther Stein, who's keeping time, and C.K. Shum, and I are here representing that group. The stars of the show are John Clegg, David Flanders, Denise Reed, you see, and Margaret Davidson. They introduce themselves better than I can. So without further ado, let's get started, John, if that's okay.
I'm a Mac user, and I find the PCs a little challenging. Okay, so I'm going to provide you some context on sea level change. I'm going to talk a little more globally. I know the session deals with the Pacific Northwest, but I want to kind of talk about some of the causes and effects, which are global, although, of course, they differ from region to region and locality to locality. And then my colleagues will talk about more local effects with, in the context of the Pacific Northwest. So just to set the stage, you know, sea level change is the norm. The one thing we can count on is that sea level changes. It's ranged in recent geologic time from up to 6 meters above the present datum to as much as 130 meters below the present datum. And in fact, as recently as 15,000 years ago, sea level was about 120, 125 meters below its present position. That's a remarkable change. However, although this change has been the norm in Earth history, we're living in unusual times, and that over the past 5,000 years, sea level has not really changed globally that much compared to what it did in the more distant geologic past. And this, I think, has had a huge impact, a kind of an unrecognized or unappreciated impact on our kind of collective attitude towards coastal communities and coastal infrastructure. It's really had a big impact on the development of civilization as we know it. There are hundreds of millions of people who live very close to the present shoreline and are assuming and have assumed back through these thousands of years that the sea is not going to change its position at all. However, we have seen recently that that's maybe not the case, that there's something, a new equation develop, or a new factor coming into play, and maybe sea level is going to change more rapidly over the coming decades than it has over the past several thousand years. I don't want to belabor this issue, but there are many, many factors that affect sea level, obviously. Some of them are quite obvious to you, the tides, the result of the gravitational effects of the moon and the sun, atmospheric circulation and ocean currents, eustatic effects I'm going to deal with in more detail, temperature and salinity variations in ocean waters have an impact on where sea level sits. There are effects of loads on the crust, loads from ice sheets, loads of sediment that are deposited on the crust can affect the level of the land, which really indirectly affects where the sea sits with respect to the land. And then you get earthquakes are changing the surface of the land surface, raising it up, sometimes dropping it down, which, again, indirectly affect where the sea is relative to the land. More recently, we've recognized that groundwater extraction is an important factor in sea level. It's a significant factor in the recent rise in sea level. It's just the extraction of water from the crust of the earth and ultimately its transmittal back into the oceans. It's not a trivial factor. So I'm going to focus just because these are the ones that I think are going to play out, going to be important, particularly important as the century progresses, on three of these factors. One is atmospheric circulation and ocean currents. The other are these global changes in sea level. And then steric effects are these changes related to the temperature and salinity of ocean waters. And pretty much ignore the rest, although these may come in, back into play when my colleagues give their presentations. So just to bear in mind that, you know, we do have these ocean-wide changes in the level of the sea that can be related to combined ocean and atmospheric circulation. The INSO phenomenon is perhaps the best known, but there are other integrated atmospheric ocean circulation phenomena in pretty much all the ocean basins that can change the level of the sea significantly. And in the Pacific Northwest, we can have changes in sea level during El Nino and La Nina events of up to several tens of centimeters that persist for months. So that's a significant factor. It's ephemeral. It doesn't last forever, but it can be important in controlling where the sea sits relative to the land. And if you have coincidence of these higher elevated sea levels related to this phenomenon and some unusual cyclonic storm, that, of course, can change, cause damage that might not otherwise occur. And then really important is eustacy. It's global sea level, anything that alters the amount of water in the oceans. And the one that's particularly pertinent in this discussion is the glacial eustatic phenomenon. And that's simply the balance between the amount of water that's locked up in glaciers, and particularly in ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica, and the amount of water in oceans. So if you have a large amount of ice on land, glacier ice on land, all other things being equal, your level of your sea is going to be lower. If we were to melt all the glacier ice on land and transfer that water into the ocean basin, sea level would be over 70 meters higher than it is today. So we don't want to enter that world, you know, the Eocene world, if you will, because of the huge impact that it would have on humanity. Not suggesting that we will, but clearly there is a relationship between the amount of ice on land and the amount of water in ocean basins. And we can see this. We know that in the recent geologic past, we've had this alternation of times when there were large amounts of ice on land, ice sheets covering Eurasia and most of North America. And at these times, sea level were quite low, up to 130 meters below where they are today. And I mentioned the state of affairs 15,000 years ago. You can see what the configuration of the Asian continent was at the time. These pale green areas were all exposed land 15,000 years ago. Conversely, 125,000 years ago, we had an interglaciation when conditions were only slightly warmer than they are today, and sea levels were up to 6 meters higher than they are today. And this is a depiction of what the southern and eastern seaboard of the United States would be 125,000 years ago when the sea was 6 meters higher than today. And that's probably a consequence of large losses of ice from Greenland and maybe Antarctica. Warmer climate, smaller amount of ice cover, the sea considerably higher than it is today. I mentioned the steric effects. Water occupies more space. It has a higher volume when it's warmer. So as oceans warm, at least the uppermost part of the water column in the oceans expands. And as a result of that expansion, sea level rises. It's thought that about half of the contribution in the last century to sea level rise has been from this effect alone, just the expansion of ocean waters, irrespective of any transfers from glaciers and ice sheets. So let's look at current sea level trends. IPCC, back in 2007, had a projection based on satellite data and tide gauges of about 2 millimeters per year rise. And that was about the amount, the rate of sea level rise during the 20th century. But as we move through this century, we're seeing that that rate is increasing, and now it's thought, the best guess is it's around 3.3 millimeters per year. Tiny amount. And I know what many of you are thinking, why worry about such a small amount? But you can extrapolate that alone to the end of the century, and you're up 30 centimeters higher than you are today. And I'll point out why that's an issue. That's a lowball estimate, because the IPCC range takes into account an acceleration of sea level rise and comes up with scenarios of about 30 to 70 centimeters sea level higher at the end of the century than today. But back in 2007, they didn't really consider what might happen to the big ice sheets. And these are really the elephants in the corner. If you melted all ice outside of Antarctica and Greenland, all land-based ice, you would raise sea level maybe a meter. That's all you're going to do. But as I say, Greenland and Antarctica have 70 meters of cape potential sea level rise in it. So it's critically important how climate change is going to impact those big ice sheets. It's important also to realize that I've been talking about global averages, but in fact, sea level rise is not the same everywhere. In fact, there are areas where it's considerably less than 3 millimeters per year, and there are areas where it's much greater than 3 millimeters per year. These are global averages, so you have to take into account the fact that it's due in part to these ocean atmospheric phenomena, in part to ocean temperature differences around the globe, that these figures are not constant. They're highly variable. So this is what we kind of know at present. Again, sea level rise at about 3 to 3.3 millimeters per year. The contributions to that rise, thermal expansion or the steric effect, is a little under half the total. Glaciers, these are kind of alpine glaciers outside of Antarctica and Greenland, contributing about a millimeter per year. And then the ice sheets are now beginning to kick in a bigger way. And that's really the big concern here, is what's going to happen to the ice sheets. And there's consistency between these estimates and the total observed using satellite altimetry. So there's some feeling that these are robust, reliable estimates of sea level rise. And just to kind of show you why that is, over the past century we've had a modest amount of global climate warming, less than a degree Celsius since the late 1800s, but it's had a huge impact on alpine glaciers. This is just ice loss, average rate of glacier thickness change in the panhandle of southeast Alaska. And you can see these ice thickness losses of glaciers in excess of many meters per year. This is a very unusual and very rapid rate of glacier ice loss in these areas. And, you know, you can just, anyone who's looked at an alpine landscape can realize that glaciers have responded profoundly and very closely. They're great thermometers for climate. Any climate change denier would need to explain what's happened to our glaciers over the past century to kind of, I think, have a reasonable case to make. And then, as I said, the real worry now is what's happening to the larger ice sheets, the ice sheets in Greenland and the East and West Antarctic ice sheets. And Greenland, for example, has experienced melting along its skirt, its periphery. These areas of pink are where surface melting has been observed where it didn't occur before. And that water that melts finds its way down into and to the base of the glacier and accelerates the rate of movement of the glacier. So you're getting larger discharges of ice through fjords and inlets into the sea, which is effectively transferring these very large amounts of ice. These are gigatons per year. This is a very large amount of ice. It's basically water that's being transferred from solid ice to the liquid state. So Greenland is beginning, it's being monitored very carefully. The data do extend back some distance in time, but the best data is really only for the last 15 years or so. So we'll see more as the decade plays out as to whether this is just a short-term or a long-term phenomenon. And then in Antarctica, what's a little bit of a concern is that these very large ice shelves are beginning to collapse or at least show signs of distress. This is the Larsen B ice shelf, and within a very short period of time, that ice shelf collapsed back in late 2001. An area of ice the size of Rhode Island was lost within a several-month period. Why is that important? This is not contributing directly to sea level rise because this is floating ice, but these are the anchors that hold basically at least the West Antarctic ice sheet in place. The West Antarctic ice sheet is grounded below sea level. When you remove these supporting fringes, you get an increased rate of flow of ice down into the sea, which then will contribute to sea level rise. So just to touch on where we might be going, these are IPCC scenarios, which, as I say, are quite conservative. They assume a certain amount of warming, and from that project a certain amount of sea level rise. These different trends, and the reason you have so much uncertainty, stems largely from emission scenarios, uncertainty about, you know, what we're going to be doing in terms of emitting carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere. And what really scares me a lot is this is just data based on the ice cores. I think this one is one of the Antarctic ice cores. We have a record now going back 800,000 years, and we can see a lockstep relationship between carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere and temperatures. So without going into details, you can see the parallelism of these two graphs, one of which represents carbon dioxide concentrations, the red curve, and the other is a proxy for temperature. There clearly is a relationship, some sort of cause and effect relationship between these two. And as I said, back 125,000 years ago, when temperatures were a little higher than they are today, sea levels were 6 meters above where they are now. Right now, we have carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at about 390 parts per million, which is in excess of any atmospheric value in the past several million years. So if there is a lockstep relationship between these two are out of equilibrium. And this, I would say, this is the IPCC scenario. It's basically a trivial rise in sea level, a 1 meter rise in sea level, by the end of the century based on a certain temperature forecast. But in fact, if we look at the geologic record, that's a low ball estimate by a long shot, and that the two systems are out of equilibrium, and that what will bring them back into equilibrium is basically the glaciers responding to elevated CO2 concentrations, pumping water into the oceans, which will significantly raise sea level. The big question is, over what period of time will that occur? How long will it take us to reestablish equilibrium between CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere and sea level? And the answer to that is highly debated. You know, Jim Hansen figures it could happen pretty much within this century. Most scientists would say it would take hundreds of years for the big ice sheets to respond in that manner. I'm not sure. I kind of probably fall somewhere in the middle on that one. So turning now to the impacts, assuming that sea level is going to rise, and I'm not giving you a sort of doomsday projection of plus 5 meters, that is a catastrophe. I don't even want to touch it. I mean, humanity can't deal with a 5 meter rise in sea level. It is going to have trouble dealing with a 1 meter rise in sea level. That's going to be very, very costly. The impacts, of course, are inundation and erosion, and 40 to 60 centimeters is basically going to probably do in some small island nations. You've probably heard of Tuvalu. They are negotiating have been in the process of negotiating a relocation of their country with a loss of their culture, of course. But there are no options here. You cannot protect these atolls from sea level rise. There's no engineering solution to that. So this is an extreme case where you basically have to abandon the shoreline and go somewhere else. And that's basically kind of towards the lower end of what is likely by the end of the century. Plausible scenarios where you're dealing with maybe 1 meter high sea levels, they have a big impact. This is just part of Seattle showing areas in red that are less, that would be inundated were they not protected if sea level was a meter higher than today. And you begin to think, well, that's not going to happen. They're going to go to extreme lengths to defend that real estate. That's extremely important real estate. But at what cost? Huge cost. And then to bring it closer to home, we have 250,000 people living on a delta plain, most of whom live below the high tide limit. And they're currently protected from both the Fraser River and the sea by a network of fringing dikes, sea dikes. So if you raise sea level 1 meter, you're clearly, I think, at least in the case of Richmond, not going to abandon that, you know. But what is the cost of improving the protective dikes to deal with 50 centimeters or a meter of sea level rise? It's going to be large. I don't know what the value is would be, but it's going to be quite large. You're going to hear more about Richmond from David. He's the next speaker. He's going to talk about some alternative strategies for dealing with more modest amounts of sea level rise. So clearly a big issue is here, how much higher is the sea going to be at the end of the century, and how are we going to deal with that? And it's really important to recognize that sea level rises relatively slowly. I'm talking millimeters per year. Even by the end of the century, probably the rates are only going to be 4 or 5 millimeters per year only. I say that's a lot, but only. But really where rubber hits the road is when you get this perfect storm of a big storm, a cyclonic storm, or high tides, a big storm surge, and sea level's already higher. That's when you're going to experience a catastrophic or a damaging event. So it's not like this is going to be happening all the time in this transitional period. You're going to have times when there's a lot of damage during storms or at high tides because you're raising the bar on which those processes operate. Coastal erosion is an attendant problem. It doesn't occur everywhere. There are coastlines that are resistant to erosion. Much of the British Columbia coast, shown here in green, is a rocky shoreline, steep rocky shorelines that will be relatively unaffected by sea level rise. But very few people live in these areas that are shown in green. Most people live in areas where you have either moderate or highly sensitive shorelines in terms of erosion, and particularly around the Strait of Georgia. So we can expect in many areas an acceleration or exacerbation of erosion that is occurring today in many coastal areas and just will be made worse in a rising sea level regime. So what can we do about this? These changes, in my mind, I'm a believer in IPCC. Scientists are locked in. Basically, sea level's going up, and nothing we can do about it now is going to make any difference. And we're not doing anything about it anyway. We're continuing to pump more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and there's every sign that that's going to continue right through this century. So these changes are locked in. It's just a question of how high the sea's going to go. So we're talking not about prevention. We're talking about adaptation. And they're the same as those that the military employ in war. You can defend or you can retreat. And you're going to be hearing more about those strategies. And in my mind, neither of them is very palatable. Defending costs huge amounts of money. Retreat costs huge amounts of money and is, in many cases, societally unacceptable. But you reach a point where retreat is forced on you. If you're up above plus 1 meter, in most places of the world, you're going to retreat. You know, you can only do so much. Engineering only will take you so far in terms of protecting the shoreline. So I guess we need to think about, you know, collectively, societally, is how we're going to deal with that problem. What mix of technology and kind of retreat we're going to adopt to deal with this problem. Thank you.
So we'll hold questions for the discussion. David? I didn't properly introduce John, but from Simon Fraser University, and David Flanders from University of British Columbia. Let's see.
Thanks.
Can we get rid of John here? Do you know where you are?
I think so. Great. Thanks very much, John. So my name is Dave Flanders. I'm actually a landscape architect and a planner. I work with Stephen Shepherd at the University of British Columbia. Our group is called the Collaborative for Advanced Landscape Planning. And we work with communities all over the place now, throughout Western Canada, in the north, now in the Arctic, and dealing with a lot of these kind of impossible issues like what John is just describing. So for our work, I'm going to talk a lot about Delta, which is just down the coastline. It's part of Metro Vancouver. I'll show you where in just a moment. And there we were working with community members to take a really hard look at adaptation strategies and what those actually might look like on the ground. And it's important to remember, we're going to walk through a whole sort of library of images, but these images are really part of this embedded process. We call this a visioning process, and this is kind of how this is a process that we kind of adapt and massage depending on community needs, where we get together with a working group and we get together with staff members and we put maps down on the table and we put pencils in people's hands and we start drawing things, and then we go back and we do some modeling, and then we come back again with some preliminary results and we do the same thing, and it's this sort of long, winding process. And Ellen Pond in our group wrote actually a guidance manual for communities that are hoping to sort of take initial steps. This kind of outlines how different communities can go through this process if people are interested. So I'll focus on Delta. Delta is, for those of you that have ever been down to Tsawwassen to take the ferry over to Vancouver Island, this is in the mouth of the Fraser River. It's literally built on the delta of the river. It faces the ocean off to the bottom left of that image. Boundary Bay there just opens up to the U.S. and to the ocean, and it's got the Fraser River on the other side. It's really kind of bound on all sides by water. And the two communities we're going to focus on very closely in this presentation are Ladner, which is kind of a community center. It's kind of the most build-up part of Delta. And then down in the bottom there is South Delta, a little more agricultural. It's a little more sort of open and pastoral down there. So I'll start off with this image. This is actually Ladner. It's kind of a community center, and this is kind of the view from on top of the dike that's currently built along the sort of main thoroughfare through Delta. And this is a bit of a damage report. This next image actually shows why doing nothing is not going to work. Doing nothing isn't actually an option at all. No one would actually let this happen. Something will happen. And this is why a response is required. This is with a sea level rise forecast of 1.2 meters, which is the guideline recommended for communities in BC to work with during a storm, right? All these things happen at once sometimes. The wind picks up, a storm surge rolls in. If it happens at high tide, you add sea level rise on top of that, and you get a perfect storm. Another view, this is Ladner again from a little higher up. And there's we used a hydrological model. Actually, someone else used it and informed this work that said, well, if there is a breach, you know, where does the water go? So all these images are based on some kind of modeling, some kind of science, a climate forecast, something. These are sort of pictures by the numbers. This isn't just our own artistic license. Stephen Shepherd calls this our scientific license. And together with the community, we came up with these four other worlds, these four scenarios, right? On the top left there, we call that hold the line, and there's a map of Delta. All the brown in the top left are the sort of quote-unquote dry spots. Those are the places you're going to protect. And hold the line is literally just, we've drawn that line in the sand, there's already dikes in Delta, so we're going to raise them. That's hold the line. Reinforce and reclaim just below is a little bit different. You can see it's all mostly dry on the inside. It's that brown patch in the inside of Delta. But we've put in some offshore infrastructure, some barrier islands, some softer approaches to take the wind and the waves out of that storm and to sort of deal with the problem out on the other side of the intertidal zone, so that by the time the water comes into the shoreline, it's not quite so bad. That's reinforce and reclaim. On the top right, we call that scenario managed retreat. In the UK, they call it coastal realignment. And in that one, you can see this brown patch really sort of shrinks, right? That's that protected patch that you're somehow armoring. And the idea is you're going to retreat out of the floodplain, that dark gray-blue area and into this sort of sacred place that you're protecting, and everything outside of that becomes retreated out of those vulnerable areas. And that last one on the bottom right is called build-up, and you can see there is no brown patch in the build-up scenario. There's a whole bunch of raised roads. So in that scenario, it's the softest we can get, and we let the water come in, and through architectural or design strategies, we deal with it, so we have a community that can deal with wet feet. So we'll start with hold the line. Then this is that same view of Ladner. From here, it kind of looks the same. But if you dip down and you're standing on that dike again, you can see this is one strategy, which would be the kind of the concrete wall strategy. This would be sort of the view out of someone's front yard as they look out. This is about how high the dike would have to be to manage for that sort of perfect storm. Another option was softer, and it kind of rolled out of that first one. People, of course, had this kind of visceral reaction to the old-fashioned concrete wall, and they thought, well, what if, you know, this could be a public amenity? What if we stick with our sort of earthen berm, something softer? And it was a great idea, so we sort of showed what that looked like, and the engineers told us that these berms need a 1-3 slope, right? And it's going to take up a whole lot of space, so you can see in that bottom image where the right-of-way was for that road. That's a major thoroughfare through Ladner. This is a community center. And in order to have space for a big earthen berm like that, you're going to lose some of your right-of-way. So we're down in South Delta, this other community, this other area we're working in. And if you look real close on the bottom there, you can see that is a raised seawall. There is a seawall right now, but that, of course, that do-nothing approach isn't going to work. So this is the raised seawall. And the sort of backyard view demonstrates what if you are going to build a wall and you're going to hit that, and you're going to use the top of wall that's based on these provincial guidelines, which again is for this perfect storm, and it might only be a 1-in-200-year storm, but if you're going to plan for that, that's how high your wall would be. Of course, this is totally impractical, and these have this very, people react very strongly. There's been opposition to raising the wall even a little bit, let alone to there's 2.5 heads high of wall there. The other problem is when a storm really rolls in, you can see in that bottom right there, there's a whole bunch of overlapping, there's whitewash, and there's a whole bunch of water that still might come up over top of the line. So you're either going to have to start reinforcing outside of that wall, or you're still going to get rained on every time the wave hits the wall when that storm comes in. So there's all kinds of problems with the engineering of that hard engineered approach. So option two is reinforce and reclaim. And in this one, this is the same community in South Delta, and this is where we're doing something off into the intertidal zone. So as sea levels rise, the intertidal zone kind of gets squeezed, and you have this coastal squeeze effect, and you're going to lose some of your habitat there. And this is the Pacific Flyway, right? Thousands upon thousands of birds fly through here twice a year. And it was important to community members that we respect that. So this kind of trickled out of that first one. Well, let's do something offshore. Right, so here's these barrier islands. These are sort of habitat-rich softscapes. The wind stops out there, the waves stop out there, and you get this sort of still, placid pond on the inside. You're still going to have to raise the wall a little bit, but not as much. So manage retreat, same community down in South Delta. And we showed this actually initially to planners, and sort of you can imagine we're sitting in this boardroom going over the research, and we're putting some images down, and they kind of scratched their heads, and this was an interesting idea, but it seemed rather extreme. They called this extreme retreat, not managed retreat. And they said, that's a far off place, and that's a difficult pill to swallow. And right before my very eyes, the planners and the engineer in the room started talking about how they would actually manage this thing. So if this is an image up to 2100, what does that look like after 10 years or 20 years or 50 years? So slowly we crafted these pictures. The first thing you would probably have to do is raise some walls, your escape routes or your basic infrastructure. And gradually over time, either through incentives or disincentives or insurance reasons, people would slowly not want to move there, and they'd potentially want to move in the highlands in the background there. So as inundation comes, though, the community still functions, and there would be many decades of a functioning community, and the road still works. But eventually, the road would be decommissioned, and this area would turn back into a kind of a cabin country or a wetland. And this is actually how development started down in South Delta. It looked a lot like this, actually, and you can see photos from 100 years ago of the boardwalk along the beach along Boundary Bay, and it would start to transition back into that. So at the end of the line, when your kids kids inherit the house and try to, you know, rebuild or whatever it is, they would be in this situation. This isn't something that would happen next year. This is many generations down the road. And the planners in the room were actually able to piece together the policy decisions that would be required for this. You know, what would you do first, 10 years down the road? How would the official community plan change for the, you know, in 5 years from now? You know, then where would the biote be? Which roads would you raise? And slowly you can actually, you know, in a stepping stone fashion, put together this, like, developmental pathway to get you there. Last scenario is called build up. And in build up, you're basically stopping investing in the diking infrastructure, and instead you're taking that money and investing it basically into roads. So you're allowing water to come in, and through architectural solutions, you can either put the living quarters of your home up on the second floor, you can raise the earth through lock block or bring in fill, and you can slowly, maybe 20 or 40 years from now, you'd raise it up enough, and then 60 or 80 years from now, as risks change, you would pop it up another meter or a few feet, or slowly you would have a more resilient community that can get wet feet. And all of these solutions perform very differently in terms of their potential impacts and in terms of the amount of roads you have to raise versus the amount of diking you have to raise. There's trade-offs to all these things, and that really became a focus of the sort of follow-up conversations that we're having now in the community. So initial feedback, as I mentioned, we're actually constructing these with community members. It's a small group of stakeholders, and you know, for example, in Hold the Line up in Ladner there, that first image I showed, people actually were okay with this idea of diking and raising the wall. You know, that's where all the homes are, that's where there's schools, that's where there's a hospital, there's a whole bunch of infrastructure there, and it's probably worth protecting that and keeping it dry. But they immediately knew a wall is not a wall is not a wall. There's all these different kinds. So immediately after seeing these pictures, they kind of knew what kind of wall or what the quality of the place would be that they wanted. And there was big implications for current policy that immediately became apparent. We had a small workshop with a dozen or so of the planning team, and they immediately started talking about, wow, if this, we're talking about raising the wall here, we're going to have to actually have to stop allowing development on that wall. There are homes up there, and that's just going to lead to conflict. And so they started talking about how can policy change right now to avoid the situation 20 years down the road where a whole bunch of brand new homes have been built, and now we're going to have to come in and say, well, sorry, but we're going to have to raise the wall. So that kind of foresight really came through by showing these images and walking through this. The thing with Hold the Line is it decreases the probability of getting wet, right? You're armoring out the wall. You're holding out the water. But the community is still very, very vulnerable, more vulnerable, actually, because sea level is rising and rising, but you're kind of keeping this whole thing out. And if in the event there is a dike breach, the damages would probably be even worse, right? It's not a resilient community. Reinforce and reclaim, some people actually they quite like this idea. It became a win-win. The environment is very high in people's priorities in Delta. And people sort of thought, well, you know, we can protect our homes and we wouldn't have to move out of this beautiful place. And the Pacific Flyway is still intact. And this was a way of kind of, you know, valuing things, valuing, you know, South Delta for ecology and valuing Ladner, for example, for our own sort of urban lifestyle. But this was really only suitable in certain places. And manage retreat then, as shocking as this one was, this trade-offs immediately started coming forward here. Manage retreat is actually a couple of things going on, right? You're sort of retreating out of some places and you're armoring up other places. It's a bit of a mix and match kind of scenario called manage retreat. And people agreed you're probably going to have to start mixing and matching and playing with these things. It's not going to be a pure one-size-fits-all solution here. And here this big question came up, well, what is the cost to buy all that land and buy all those people out compared to the cost of raising all those walls, because that's really, really expensive, and there's going to be some fights involved in raising those walls, right? So, bang, immediately it becomes obvious that someone's going to have to do a feasibility study and figuring out what the cost is of option A versus option B. The other question that kind of comes up, and it really does beg this question, is in this scenario, we would be sacrificing some amount of agriculture. delta is over half agriculture. This whole question of food security becomes central here. And here we're retreating out of agricultural land, and one of the farmers in our working group said, once agricultural land gets really salty, it's really, really difficult to bring it back into production without enormous amounts of fresh water and irrigation, et cetera. And slowly our water table is rising, it's brackish. Right, so that's a question. Do we want to sacrifice agriculture for a suburban paradise, right? And lastly, build-up was really interesting. Build-up, some people started talking about how build-up would potentially end up alleviating the public purse, at least directly, public funds, from funding this enormous capital works project. Right? Instead, build-up, where you're allowing homeowners to decide how they want to do it, you know, you can design your own house and figure it out, but this is basically saying by the time your kids inherit your house and tear it down and build up their own thing, it's going to have to be at this new standard, and that standard is going to be a brand new finished floor elevation or a new flood construction level, and that's the standard you're going to have to, they're going to have to work with, and they can decide how to do it however they want. And a really interesting side effect came out of this discussion. Is a planner in the room actually brought this up, which is kind of interesting. It's really expensive to raise a house. It's tens of thousands of dollars, but it makes it much easier to pay for if you can share that cost with your neighbor. So all of a sudden you get duplexes so that they could share the cost of building up. It'd be even cheaper per person if you could build a triplex or a townhouse, right? So it would be this implicit, wherever build up is going to roll out on the landscape, it would be this kind of implicit incentive to densify. You'd have these small, high, dense pockets of development popping up here and there and everywhere. That would alleviate costs, and it would just happen naturally, right? People are going to try to save money, which is kind of interesting. They could also build on existing incentives, right? There's already float homes in this community, and as soon as people saw one of those houses there on the right, it's actually a float home, they thought, holy smokes, we actually have a policy that could help make this happen. So there are policies, there's seeds within the soup of policy in Delta that they could actually build on, and probably aren't going to have many fights because there's these nice incentives to build float homes. People kind of like that idea, and rolling and you know, spending more time and crafting those kinds of policies could lead to a build-up situation. Last thing is in contrast to hold the line, that first option, build-up doesn't decrease the probability of something bad happen at all, right? In fact, the risk of getting wet is much higher. The thing is this is a resilient community. It doesn't matter if it gets wet. It's designed to get wet. You don't have to put all your eggs in one basket and hold all the water out with a wall. This is a resilient community. And vulnerability, you know, overall risk is made up of those two things, the probability of something bad happening and our vulnerability to it. Hold the line decreases the probability by putting up the wall. Build up just creates a vulnerable community. So it can get wet. It's a soft approach. So I'll end it there. Really, if I can try to come up with some kind of punchline, is that there's no silver bullet here. There was no perfect solution. We didn't go about this trying to find what the ideal strategy is for Delta. The ideal strategy doesn't exist. There's trade-offs. And this process has been effective, I think, at understanding the myriad of options out there, where some things are suitable, maybe more importantly, where they're not suitable. That becomes very clear when you show a picture of it. And how to get there, what is that pathway, and really assessing the trade-offs, the repercussions of these decisions of committing to one pathway versus another. And I think that's really a big part of just making more informed decisions. Thank you.
Are you on here? Got it.
Yeah. Good afternoon, everybody. Going to switch gears just a little bit now. John and David have been talking about the human environment, and I'm going to talk essentially about the natural environment and particularly about coastal wetlands. I work at the University of New Orleans, and so spend a lot of time working on a different delta, but I'm not actually going to talk about Louisiana today. I'm going to talk about this part of the country, this part of the continent, and part of that is because I am part of a National Research Council committee that is currently coming up with some new sea level rise estimates for the west coast of the US, and that report is forthcoming, hopefully in a couple of months. So the bottom line here, three things, just in case you have to leave at the end. Sea level rise is a threat to coastal marshes, undoubtedly, but it might not be the biggest one in some parts of the country and perhaps some of these areas up here. What's going to happen on the west coast? Well, the good news here is that we have some resource to deal with this, and there are some places locally where there may be some, we could be more strategic about what we do and have a more optimistic future for our coastal marshes. And what can we do? Well, sometimes we probably just need to not do anything or maybe remove some of the things that we've done in the past. So we'll explore those three things here very briefly. Just quickly, and this is probably not relevant, because we're on the west coast anyway, so if you have any image of a coastal marsh and you're from this area, you probably have this kind of image. West coast marshes are different generally from east coast marshes in terms of tidal range, also in the kind of plants that grow in them. That is not that important in terms of my comments this afternoon, but what it does mean is that they're slightly less well understood in terms of their dynamic. Most of the studies of coastal marshes and sea level rise have been done on the mid-Atlantic or the southeastern coast of the United States or even the Gulf Coast where I work. And so we take some principles and processes and understanding from those systems, but some of the specifics in terms of orders of magnitude and the actual values and things like that may still need a little bit of work out here. Essentially, there are a number of different environments within which marshes occur in this area, and those do become important. Which one of these is the pointer? This is the Skagit Delta flowing into Puget Sound. We heard just now about the Fraser River Delta and these deltaic systems. Very extensive. That's the place where, at least historically, there were very extensive areas of coastal marsh. That does become important. They also exist along the margins of and in kind of sheltered areas in numerous places around the coast. This one, I believe, is in Glacier Bay. But they still have the general characteristics, I think, of marshes across most of the coast of the U.S. So sea level rise in coastal marshes. There's a conventional wisdom out there that marshes are doomed. And they're not, in a nutshell. They do have a remarkable ability to keep up with sea level rise. And this rather complex cartoon here, which I will just generally describe, comes from a report written by Ron DeLorme, 20 years ago at least. So this is something we've known for a while. And so what happens here essentially, this is a piece of marsh grass. It's not meant to be a cypress tree. It's meant to be a piece of marsh grass in my cartoon. And this is the level of the water at high tide, and it's sitting in the soil here, time one. What happens between time one and time two over here? Two things happen. The land subsides, as it does in some areas, and we'll see some of that in a moment. But also sea level rises, as it does, as John described. And so what happens at time two is essentially that the marsh grass is still there, the relative height of the water is relative to the marsh surface is still about the same, but what we have is more soil. And essentially, we have the ability to build soil. And we have two mechanisms that allow us to do that. One is sediment deposition, and that actually is really quite important in this area here, as well as the development of marsh peat, which in some more southern parts of the West Coast is also important. So these are the processes that are going to control whether or not our marshes survive sea level rise is peat accumulation. We need healthy plants for that, and sediment deposition. So it's all about the rates at which these things occur. But importantly, you know, there are other things going on in this area. We've just seen, I think, some excellent representation from David about how these large areas of former marshland in the Fraser Delta are now essentially municipalities or agriculture, but not, for the most part, natural coastal habitats, which they were historically. And so when we think about what happens in areas like this and what's going to happen in the future for coastal wetlands, if we think back to the 20th century, then we recognize that we have actually done a lot to these systems already. And threats associated with coastal development, I don't know, was it 2 more million people were expecting around the shores of Puget Sound within the next 50 years or so? Massive amounts of coastal development are expected. People love living by the sea. People love living that, liking that view of the water and being close to the shoreline. And so shoreline and coastal development is clearly an issue, as well as what we do upstream. What happens at the coast is intimately connected with what happens in our coastal watersheds, and we have some extremely important resources within our coastal watersheds in this part of the world, and we have done a lot of things in those watersheds which have implications downstream. So one of the things that we have to consider when we think about sea level rise and I guess what I've called it, Northeast Pacific marshes. I was struggling for a term that captured the northwest part of the U.S. and the southeast part of Canada, so I guess we focus on the ocean rather than the continent here. Is, you know, we have these predictions of what goes on in the ocean, and this is just for the slide, really, something from IPCC 2007 that John already discussed. We also have to consider, importantly, what the land is doing. And so one of the things that occurs in this part of the country, which is slightly different from many other parts of at least the United States, is there is very variable what we call vertical land motion, right? Not only is sea level not doing the same thing in all across the world, which John showed very well in that slide, but the actual land mass is doing different things as well. And so this is just an example from a slide from Mazzotti, which I believe this is based on GPS data. And just look at, you know, so that what we're looking at here is Vancouver Island here, obviously Puget Sound in this area. And so a range here from areas which are actually experiencing negative relative sea level rise to positive sea level rise. And so this is because there are various things going on within the land surface. Some of this is associated with tectonic activity or faults or things, the different kinds of tectonic activity occurring in different places. It might actually be a lowering of the surface of the land because of groundwater withdrawal or other kinds of processes. And also in the future, there may be some other kind of gravitational changes that occur as a massive ice sheet melt occurs, as has been discussed previously. It's not all the same everywhere, and that's really the most important point there. So what is going to happen in this area? Well, a study was recently done, sponsored by the National Wildlife Federation, that actually looked at what would happen to coastal habitats in sea level rise. And one of the important things, I hope, points that I made just now, I think, is how fast the sea level rise is important, because there is a limit to how fast the coastal marshes can build that soil up. There's a limit to how fast they can actually raise the elevation of the marsh surface. And that's what we call, the accretion rate. And in this particular study, it was assumed that the marsh accretion rate would be of the order of 3.6 to 3.75. My goodness, that's awfully precise, at some time into the future. And what they found in this study was essentially that coastal habitats generally changed. They didn't disappear. And actually salt marsh habitats took over many other different kinds of systems. And there was actually an increase in the amount of salt marsh at the expense of more inland coastal wetland types. So let's think about these rates for a minute. You know, how fast these things are going to happen, how fast sea level is going to rise, and how about how fast the coastal marsh can rise to keep up with it. So, you know, just in general terms, we've got, this should be 4 to 7 millimetres per year here. I always think in rates, so I just think in millimetres. It's always per year for me, sorry. And so if we take this, and obviously we recognize, as John pointed out, that there are some glacier and there are some ice sheet contributions which are not in this fourth assessment report number, then we add in this vertical land motion component, then what kind of thing could happen here? So this is a map of Puget Sound now. Where are we down here? Tacoma's down here, Olympia's down here, Seattle's up here in the middle somewhere. I should have put some labels on it. I'm sorry. So this is from the Finnegan study, which looks at essentially INSAR data, which is a satellite radar technique that basically bounces radar signals off of hard surfaces and comes back several years later and does the same thing and looks at how the elevation has changed. So this is based on a kind of satellite radar technique. And so what you see here, I want to point out the scale here, and this is net change in elevation over a very relatively short period of time. I think this particular diagram is the difference between 2002 and 2006. So over a 4 to 5 year period here, the red hot colors go up four millimeters a year going up, and the blue colors 4 millimeters a year going down. And so what you see on here is there's a lot of spatial variability. And so there are some places here where, at least over short periods of time, we've seen change going up or change going down at the same kind of rates that we're predicting that global sea level rise might change. And so in some places that means that you're going to have these global rates plus some subsidence going on. But in other places, there may be the case where sea level is going up and the land surface the changes in the land surface elevation do to some extent compensate for it. And so what that means is that those rates that we saw on the last slide of 3.6, 3.7 millimeters a year could actually mean that if the marsh can do that, it can keep its head above the water. But the other thing that's really important here is that where makes a big difference. This is very, very local stuff. If we're going to be strategic and really think about making some effort to restore coastal marshes in the Pacific Northwest or in this region of Southeast Canada, then we really have to think about what's going on at the local level. Here, I've been focusing on the local kind of elevation side of it. But we also have to think about what these other things are going on are too. And so this is just a general slide from the climate change assessment, most recent one from the U.S., looking at the number of different factors that affect whether a marsh is going to survive or not. And you'll notice that one of these in here is altered river flows. And the idea that some of the dams and the catchment management practices that we've had in this area have limited sediment input coming down to the coast, and that kind of thing may be another local factor that we have to take into account. So let me just switch gears for a little bit, and I'll come back and sum that up at the end here. So I've been focusing so far on the vertical. How do we allow marshes to keep their head above the water, if you like, as the sea level rises? And so that's the issue that we've been talking about. There's also the concept out there, a kind of conventional wisdom, that marshes will not survive as sea level rises because they have nowhere to go, that they have to actually migrate horizontally. And so I want to explore that just for a few minutes here, because I think the difference between the vertical and the horizontal and understanding them separately is actually really important to thinking about what's going to happen to marshes in the future. Essentially, they have to accrete vertically to stay, to survive, essentially. But higher sea level also means that more land on the landward side of a coastal marsh is flooding, and so the marsh could move on shore. I've got some really rather crude cartoons here for this, so please bear with me. So in this situation, the rate of sea level rise is approximately the same as the rate at which the marsh is building. And so basically everything's moving up together. Sea level rises, the marsh builds up, and essentially the marsh survives. And because sea level rises, this is the land surface here in brown, because sea level rises from time one to time two, a new area is flooded and it can be colonized and we get new marsh. So that's good if the vertical processes are in balance. But let's look at the situation where the vertical processes are not in balance, where the rate of sea level rise is greater than the marsh's ability to build vertically. So do we get an area of new marsh in here? Well, let's kind of explore that. So what's going to happen then is, remember that the rate of sea level rise is greater than the rate of marsh surface elevation change. So as the sea level goes up from T1 to T2, this area over here becomes newly inundated and so is colonized by marsh grass. This area over here is not keeping up, so it's gradually losing relative elevation. Let's go to time three now. Sea level is going to continue to rise. And so not only is the marsh that we had at the beginning of this story losing relative elevation, but the bit that we just created is also losing relative elevation too. We've got a newly inundated piece here, and so we keep getting a little bit on the landward side. But essentially, unless these marshes can keep up with sea level as it rises, then what we end up with is, and this is very crude, I apologize for the graphics here, this area here is going to be gone. And what we're going to end up with, if we have this imbalance, is just a rim, a bathtub rim, if you like, of marsh around the edge of our upland. We are not going to get more and more and more as if we allow the marsh to migrate horizontally. We're just going to essentially have an amount of marsh which is controlled by the slope of the land surface and the difference between high and low tide. So unless we can accrete vertically, horizontal migration really doesn't make much of a difference in terms of keeping some extensive coastal marshes in this area. So what can we do? What can we do? The key thing here is to get those vertical processes going. We have to allow for sediment delivery. That means that we have to capitalize on the resources that we have in our coastal watersheds. One of the things I want to say about this area being different is it rains a lot, clearly, but you also have these very steep catchments. You have, obviously, a mountain range right next to the coast, very steep catch, very high rates of sediment delivery. Estimates from the USGS say 6.5 million tons of sediment a year into Puget Sound from coastal rivers. And you can see some of them bring in a lot. This is Puget Sound here. This is from the USGS. This is the Skagit, I think. Some of them bring in a lot. Others bring in less. The Fraser River that we've heard around already, obviously a much larger catchment than many of these here, drain a large part of British Columbia, 20 million tons of sediment. That sediment has to go into coastal marshes. And what that means is that we have to allow that sediment to spread across the landscape. We actually have to get it into areas where the marshes are. Down here in the southern part of Puget Sound, there's been some restoration recently in the Nisqually National Wildlife Refuge, where some dikes that had essentially isolated a wetland area from both the river and the tide have recently been removed, and even in the first year after dike removal, we get 30 millimeters a year of sedimentation, right? This is clearly enough to keep up with sea level rise. And so the resources are there. That's one of the reasons that this area is actually different from many parts of the United States, not just because there's this local geology and all these changes that might give us some opportunities as far as the vertical land motion is concerned, but because we have the sediment resources within our rivers if we can work out how to use it. So if we can match these two things together and identify the places where we can make this work and invest in those areas, then I think there is hope. And so back to these points then, yes, sea level rise is a threat, but there are other things out there too. There may be some places, if we think strategically on the West Coast, where we actually can have some hope. And in many cases, the best intervention is no intervention. Get rid of the dikes, allow the sediment to move through the dams, and we can have a chance of having some really vibrant and very valuable coastal habitats in this area in the future. Thank you.
So this part of the program is your part of the program. My name is Margaret Davidson. I'm from the U.S., the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. I'm a coastal person. Spent the early part of my career in South Louisiana. I now live in Charleston, South Carolina, 5 feet above sea level, so this isn't just a professional issue. It's a personal issue. So with that, first of all, my job is to make this part of the discussion happen. So if you've got some great questions, raise your hand. Let's hear them. If you don't, I have some questions. And if you're feeling shy, oh, I knew you wouldn't. Okay, let me get this gentleman in the middle, and then I'll get to you, sir.
Mm-hmm. And it was a very good documentary. I was thinking that's a good idea for us here to do an assessment visually, dramatically, about what a meter means. Mm-hmm. Also, the tidal basin in BC seems an obvious candidate for this sort of analysis as well, to give serious, detailed warning, because a lot of people aren't getting it.
And in fact, I'm going to Flanders. Do you want to go for that first? Although I can tell you that the National the U.S. National Park Service, which actually has the authority for the tidal basin in Washington, D.C., is right now looking at what can be done to contain the tidal basin. Yes, this gentleman who is local here with a science museum, was that it, was actually speaking about the use, the value of things like Flanders had done, the visualization so that people can understand what it means to have these changes in the water level, what it means to them and their communities and their landmarks. And he also raised the issue that of the tidal basin in Washington, D.C., which is just a little ways away from the U.S. Capitol. I myself, it's not the opinion of my agency, but it might not be so bad for it to be swamped. Okay? Not the opinion of the people who pay me, though.
Sure.
Okay, Flanders and then Reed. I saw Denise had her hand up.
I love the suggestion of putting together some kind of documentary-style communication piece to get these impacts across and these risks across, and more importantly for us, I think the solutions across. There are options and there are ways to move forward. I think we know in our research we actually test the efficacy of these visualizations and we test how they can shift people's perceptions, and we know that they can shift people's willingness to act, people's understanding of these issues, people's understanding of the options, and we've actually gone through these questionnaires, and we know that mediums like this can actually change how people think about these things and their willingness and their perceived ability to do something about it. I think as long as something could be, Stephen Shepard always says defensible drama. You mentioned this sort of dramatic, the benefit of dramatically showing a meter of sea level rise, and we always say as long as the drama is defensible, then it's less likely for someone to just go, oh, that's just like that movie, you know, The Day After Tomorrow. You know, there's a tendency that we have that's like, that's probably just special effects. Whereas in our work, at one point, a community member that lived in that front line of houses in South Delta was incredible. She came to our workshop and she says, actually, it's kind of placid. The storm doesn't look like that. She said, actually, the storm, what happened when I was in my house, in my living room in 2004, is a stump started trying to jump over the seawall into my backyard. That's what a storm looks like. And we've kind of left that behind in order to remain more defensible than drama. So it would take a very wise and creative and, I think, thoughtful director to put that together well.
I absolutely agree. I mean, I think there's a lot of good that we can do with documentary media, and I think that David's point about defensible visualizations is really important. One of the things that I think we really can do very well, and I think it's underlying the visualizations that you saw, is that we actually mesh up the natural science with the social science here to get this together. And so one of the things that I'm very keen on, very adamant about, is that we don't just use these kind of what I call bathtub models, where we take the kind of these wonderfully detailed topographic images of coastal areas that we can now get from LIDAR and just superimpose the water level on them if it's a natural environment. If it's a built environment that's just going to sit there and get flooded, then that's fine. But if it's a natural environment, we have to be able to incorporate that response element too. And we can do that. I think, you know, that the study that I show from NWF, even with the SLAM model, you can show that the marshes don't just sit there and drown; they actually change their character. And so we can put these things together. We don't very often have the opportunity to do that, but I think something that really shows people not just how their human environment is going to change, but how the natural environment is also going to change and be different, not just be totally lost, is a key thing. And I thought that one of the things that you showed was very compelling, I can't remember which option it was that had the natural islands in there. You know, there was a change. They were providing some shelter. And so if we know on the natural science side that if you have options like that that the people want to have, we can work out how big those waves are going to be. We can work out what difference that's going to make in the wave run-up and how big that levee then has to be. And so I think putting the things together in that sense is really very, very good and can be very powerful.
Well, in fact, I'd only add to that that we also need to recognize that as you pointed out, there's difference in vulnerability in habitats. There's also difference in vulnerability of populations to exactly the same exposure and different vulnerabilities of critical infrastructure. So I think that's important to understand as well, because humans have different response rates depending upon how thick their wallet is. Right.
Yeah, and who's paying is another important thing. The idea of being able to explore public infrastructure, private infrastructure, and natural environment, all of these things together, as well as, I mean, your point about the tidal basin, notwithstanding the comment about its specific location, the idea of historical and cultural assets, for want of a better term, and how we can think about those, whether they still have their same value if they are moved. And there are some things that you just lose if you move. And this is a really good idea.
Yeah. Right. Gentlemen, yes? Who are you anyway?
My name is John Englander.
Okay.
There's something about this. I just spent about 2 years writing a book about sea level rise and coastal impacts. So I'm conversing with you. And you all brought great vantage points and perspectives. Can we do anything? And the one last point about the practical aspects of the sea level stuff is that, as some of you alluded to, but it's not just what happens to sea level and the different variations around the world, but it is that intermittent storm surge, pink tides, they call them. Okay, once the property is not underwater, whether it's farmland or a house, you pretty much destroy the value.
Yes.
You
know,
Any responses here on the panel?
Well, yeah, I think I don't disagree with anything you said. I did just want to add one point about these, the king tide or the extreme event, from the natural environment perspective, that those are actually really important. And they can actually provide the stimulus that the systems need to keep going. And so one of what I call the, and this is not a Northwest story, this is a Louisiana war story, if you like, but one of the cruel ironies of hurricanes like Katrina is actually bringing a huge amount of sediment to the coastal wetlands. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the ways that any of those coastal wetlands in the Mississippi Delta down there actually survive. Mm-hmm. It's because the sediment that is remobilized during coastal storms. So the natural systems, have these some ability, depending on how rapidly things go, some ability to adjust to these things. We just have not built our human systems with that same level of resilience.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You can't. I kind of overstated that a bit. I think we have to struggle with this in the context of climate change and altering behavior. I'm just not particularly optimistic when I see the way things are going. And it's kind of interesting in this discussion, it is rates and where we're going, where we're going to end up in another century. The worst case scenarios, there's no solutions to those other than kind of you just vacate the land. I think these alternative scenarios work for sea level changes that are kind of within the region of what is expected by most scientists. But if Jim Hansen's scenario plays out, all this is basically academic. If we're looking at sea levels that are 5 meters higher at the end of the century, you can't do anything but retreat from those. You know, there's no engineering solution that will deal with those, in my opinion.
He did say, and he said the quantities, of course, is the only thing we can do, that we still have a chance to stop that effect. Okay? And as scared as he is, he's probably the leading scientist out there for 30 years. Very pointed in saying, and he's got the numbers, if you burst in the carbon, remove the driver, and it won't get that worse.
Okay.
Well, on that issue of climate adaptation, we could make some interesting bets. Yes, sir.
I'd just like to add that the Morgan's banks and companies, you.
Yes, yes. Speaking to the issue of how the insurance and financial services sectors could motivate our human behavior. In that regard, just a few years ago, Lloyd's of London, which is a fairly well-known reinsurance agency, so they're the guys who insure the casualty loss insurance. So if you have an insurance policy on your house, which you have to have if you borrowed money from a bank, if you didn't borrow money from a bank, you don't have to have an insurance policy. But reinsurance guys are the guys who bail out the casualty loss guys when they have to pay out after Katrina or after Irene in the northeast U.S. or after other major catastrophic events. Lloyd's of London sent out an open letter to the casualty loss insurance industry a few years ago that basically said, if you're not paying attention to this climate change stuff, we suggest you get into a new line of business. So I don't know about in Canada, but I do know in the U.S. that there have been a number of markets in which the casualty loss guys have either withdrawn issuing new policies or substantially raised the rates on existing policies. And in the case of Florida, the elected insurance commissioners would not permit them to raise their rates, and so they withdrew from the market entirely. The state of Florida established a catastrophic loss fund, and most people who are fairly knowledgeable about this believe that it's undervalued, underfunded, on the order of about a tenth of what would be needed if a Category 5 storm were to hit South Florida in a populated area. So this is one of our challenges. The other part is that insurance commissioners tend to be elected, and we know how people do with getting elected when they say, let's raise rates or let's raise taxes. So in the back of the room, and then we'll get you, sir. Yes, ma'am. Stand up.
Please.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Critical public infrastructure, how we site and design it, shapes everything about our human settlement. And the amount of money that we have to raise to build any public infrastructure is substantial and often has a stated design lifetime of somewhere between 30 and 50 years, and I know in the east coast of the U.S., much of our public infrastructure, roads, sewers, water supply systems are actually over 100 years old. So this is a very important point, and it's not something that should be pushed off decades from now when we have more clarity. Are we talking a meter? Are we talking a meter and a half? Are we talking 2 meters over the next 5 decades, when, in fact, we're going to have to design for something that is much different than right now? A couple of comments, one quick comment. You know, sometimes people who don't get the climate issue might get the extreme event issue. Natural disasters is a pretty clear trend line. When it comes to coastal inundation, it doesn't matter if we're talking today or 7 decades from now. Everything our populations need to do to hold down the ever-escalating costs of these disasters can be taken right now, and it's the same strategies on whatever time scale you do buy into. Yes, sir.
Yes, John Addison from San Francisco, about 20 meters above sea
level. Lucky you. In the back, do you hear him? He says, if in fact Dr. Jim Hansen were correct and we were looking at a meter over the next couple of decades,
later in this century, 20-year period.
Okay. 20-year period. Okay, if we had an acceleration in the rate of sea level rise, what would be the prognosis for the various areas that our panel is most familiar with? Is that a fair statement? Okay. So, Denise, you're down there where we have talked for decades about how you're the analog for what happens when the stuff hits the fan.
Yeah, well, that's really the fan, isn't it? I think 20 years is pretty difficult for that's beyond anything that we've measured for a natural environment for coastal wetlands to survive. And so, you know, in the sense of you know, maybe they can do things that we don't know about, you know, in terms of I think that the all bets are pretty much off. I'm generally recognized as an accretionary optimist, but I'm not optimistic over those kinds of scenarios for cities. You know, I think that what happens with and again, this is a comment on coastal Louisiana. What happens is people start to move after events. You know, it's not that every year it gets higher. It's going to be that minor tropical storm superimposed on that is just so much higher than that kind of storm used to be that makes people move, and people do move, and people do elevate their houses. Where I live, we have a fairly successful housing elevation program, and that's because funds have been made available, not through the normal hazard mitigation program, but because of some of the federal money that came to Louisiana after Katrina. That is being handed out in chunks of $100,000 for people to raise their homes. And what it's generated is a very active commercial sector. Companies that want to help people raise their homes, they'll do all the paperwork, they'll get the grant money for people, they'll front the money, those kinds of things. And whether that's a good idea or not is another matter. But with that kind of rate of rise, you know, that's without an end in sight. That if you had a rate of rise like that, it wouldn't stop after 20 years. It would just keep going. Then relocation has to be the only option. I'm moving to Cape Girardeau.
Yes. Sure. I mean, no one has a crystal ball here of what the heck the world would do if all of a sudden in 20 years we had a meter more water. But what we can actually look at what is going on And we do have actually examples in Delta of community adaptation that's kind of happened under the radar without anyone even realizing it. And I think humans are remarkably adaptable creatures, really adaptable. And different cultures have shown that in different ways. And someone once coined resilience to me as the ability to simply just self-organize, to reorganize in terms of crisis. And I think some communities are going to have really strong foundations to be able to reorganize. And one example I think of that is in Delta, is the Tsawwassen First Nation. We started looking at our maps, our topographic maps of Delta, and we could see in the band lands, which is right down on the water, right in the thick of it, we could see they had already started raising up the elevation of the ground, and it actually showed up in our topographic models. We couldn't figure out why the native reserve was higher than everything else around it, is because they've already started building up. And this is like very few resources here in this community, but they have a strong community. They've also started reinforce and reclaim. So when you look at the coast, we found this little sinuous line out sort of a couple hundred or a few hundred meters off the coast of the water. The band decided that they wanted to reinforce and reclaim before anyone else was talking about it. So with limited resources, I think with a strong community, you can reorganize and we'll adapt.
Just a quick comment. It's more than just sea level. A meter rise in sea level in 20 years in Richmond is going to raise the water table a meter. The water table is already at the surface. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're going to have to deal with higher waters irrespective of whether they're freshwater or seawater.
And I live in Charleston, which is actually one of the oldest settlements in the U.S., and it's actually largely built on fill. And when we ran a visualization tool similar to what Flanders had did for Charleston, and we just – sorry, Denise, it was a fairly simple bathtub model. It showed that we went – and we're a tourist-based economy. Let me make that clear. We're a tourism-based economy. That we went from having extreme high tides, crotch-high tides in downtown Charleston six times a year to more than 200 times a year. which could have some profound consequences on the willingness of people to come wait in lovely downtown Charleston, right? So, John, I see you, but I got two other people at least to get before you. Asking about the rate of change in Puget Sound is shown by LIDAR, which is an instrument flown out of an aircraft.
Yeah, that was actually not INSAR is slightly different from LIDAR, and that's probably about all I should say there because I probably shouldn't be the person explaining the details. But I think one of the key points there is that those are pretty short-term rates that you can get with this. We don't have anything yet with our new satellite tools that allows us to really match up the long-term trends that we see from something like a tide gauge record, where you take into account all of those ups and downs that we know happen in certainly on the oceanic side of things, and detect a long-term trend. And so I think one of the things that's really, I don't know if it offers hope for the 21st century, but we really do have a whole lot more technical tools at our disposal now in terms of things like INSAR, in terms of things like LIDAR, so we can get really good topographic change. The GRACE opportunity to really look at how, you know, the mass of the Earth really changes and adjusts, and I know CK knows much more about that than I do. So the rates on that study, the slide that I showed was the extraction for 2002-2006, but there were other kind of periods that they looked at too. So how they match up with the Seattle tide gauge would be the way to look at it. But again, when you look at short intervals, you should not match those with the long-term trend. That's a kind of science thing we have to learn. And I'll be happy to provide you with the citation for that.
Just so you know, Denise, you would have to use SAR in the Pacific Northwest because it actually sees through clouds, whereas LIDAR has to have cloud-free. And I don't know that there's that many cloud-free days this way. Okay, and I thought I saw another. Oh, you have another point?
For David, okay. Related to interest in drinking water in the communities that you study.
He's asking about drinking water impacts.
Actually, that was one thing we looked at. I wasn't even able to talk about some of our other communities that we're working in, but in the North Shore, so right across the water here, the beautiful view of North Vancouver and West Vancouver, we were actually able to work with climate modelers there, and they modeled how the snowpack would slowly, slowly climb up the mountains, and that, of course, has a direct impact on what's right down in the watershed, which is the Capilano Reservoir, which is where some of our drinking water comes from. And if it doesn't come from there, it comes from the reservoir next door. So absolutely some of these impacts would affect our ability to harvest water for drinking. Yeah.
Okay. An elected official. All right.
Thank you for coming. Thank you.
Wow, are you newly elected? Okay. Basically, she was asking what these folks think about how we might actually begin to make science-informed, rational, logical decisions as opposed to fear-based discussions. Yes, okay.
Yeah.
And denial. Yes, yes.
Well, I hate to say it, but I think it's a matter of awareness and education. We can't expect politicians to move unless the public recognizes this as an issue. And in this particular case, I think it's a bit under the radar screen. It's kind of not recognized as being as serious a problem as I think it is. Climate change, you know, is linked to it, but climate change has really received most of the media attention. This is an impact of climate change. I think it's a very important one. And most people just aren't even aware of it as an issue.
Yes. challenge being to bring logic and knowledge to the process as opposed to just reading Fox News.
I was going to suggest that, first of all, thank you for coming. This is a good sign, don't you think? We've actually been invited to present this work, if you can believe it or not, to Delta Council and Mayor Lois Jackson. Delta is really blessed to have such a talented group in their staffing and such an open-minded council. We've been working with Delta since 2006, and I think our answer to that question of how do you bring science to policy is to design a process around it. It's really no good just taking one of those images of that and saying, well, see, this is you. You actually have to spend time with the community, spend time with the planners, spend time with stakeholders that you think could speak on behalf of their community, and slowly package this thing together. And it's taken us years, but we have this trusting relationship built up with the community because it's been this rigorous, defensible, scientific, transparent process, and that, I think, brings you closer to changing policy.
Well, I think the most important part of that, besides the rigorous and defensible part, is the relationships and the building of trust, being a trusted resource. Denise, I saw your hand. My own experience has been since 2005, which is when Katrina hit some southern states, I've been working with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which at one level officially is a big climate denier antagonist organization. But one part of the chamber recognized they actually represent the small to medium enterprises. And what they recognize, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico, and now it's extended not just across the U.S., but actually internationally, is that even if they help their members to be more disaster resilient, this is why I brought up the issue about extreme events, even if they got their business members to be more resilient so that they could get back to business sooner, which was not the case in the Gulf of Mexico. In fact, 70% of the small businesses that existed before Katrina never came back, okay, along much of the northern Gulf of Mexico coast. But even if they could get back to business, because the communities couldn't get back to business, there was no one to buy their goods and services. So now they recognize that they have an economic relationship that extends beyond their own personal business unit. So they've developed this whole disaster resilient initiative. I say this because in many communities in the U.S., at least, the chamber is a force for what you do or don't get to discuss in a public forum. Okay, I'll say it that way. Denise?
Yeah, I just wanted to make one point, though. One piece, and this is where somebody like you could really make a big difference, is don't get caught up in the decimal places, right? Some of the scientists are going to say they're not sure whether it's 2.56 or 2.57, and that's going to be a big problem. And maybe it is for their tenure, but for your public policy, it doesn't really matter.
Exactly.
And so, you know, that is where leadership from folks like you can really make a difference in terms of cutting through some of the kind of stuff that you're going to get from some scientists, right? Pick your scientists. Be selective. Not selecting your science. That's not what I'm trying to say. But some scientists are much better at giving you the kinds of information that you need than some others. And so, you know, it's not about the decimal places. It's about the big trends here. You know, we're not worried. Anybody in this room is not worried about whether it's 0.4 meters or 0.41 meters, right? The fact is that that's a lot, right? That's where you need to go.
Okay. One more in the back, John, and then you can have your second bite. Okay. Stand up, please, ma'am. I can't even hear you.
We're going running late. I guess we are running late, but that's okay. I need to go in a minute.
Mm-hmm. So she's asking about the question of all this critical public infrastructure, water supplies, sewer supplies, and that culturally we tend to build them underground. Let me raise another issue, and then I'll let them, that I think accompanies it, that we tend not to think about much. But historically, humans have tended to dump a lot of their toxic and hazardous waste into coastal swamps. And as water levels begin to rise, a lot of that crap is going to be mobilized and present an additional challenge to freshwater aquifers as well as just ordinary human health. But Flanders.
I really appreciate that comment, actually. I think you're exactly right. Sadly, in our visualizations, we're not actually showing all the stuff that's under there, under the ground, and in the electricity. You know, beneath each one of those roadways is a thoroughfare of cables and pipes and tubes, and a lot of it is gravity-fed. Right now, actually, Delta is largely dependent on a pumping strategy. There's sort of ditches and dikes, and there is drainage in Delta, and basically it gets so far and kind of gets to the dike, and they have to pump it all out, and you would be exasperating this whole process and increasing this reliance on pumping and pumping and pump it out. While, of course, you're irrigating to keep the salts out of the agricultural land. So in short, you're absolutely right, and that's a huge issue that I think a lot of people haven't actually come to grips with, is not only is it our roads and our hoses and our schools we've got to worry about, but all of the infrastructure that we've invested in these communities, right? One thing that came out of our discussion with planners was in that build-up scenario where you're sort of figuring out ways of raising your property up on piles or on fill or concrete or whatever it is, that would wreak absolute havoc on the local drainage. As soon as your neighbor decides to go and build up, you're going to get the brunt of all of his and all of their all of your own rainwater. So job number one in our sort of pathway to build up was essentially a whole bunch of hard engineering feasibility studies and technical studies on how you would actually jury-rig some kind of alternate water and sewage and power distribution in the community. Yeah, most people don't think of that.
Just as an added wrinkle, when you start to build up in Richmond, you cause the land to subside. It's very well documented that historic development in Richmond has caused significant subsidence of the land. Now, that does taper off with time, but kind of you're almost contributing to the very problem you're trying to solve.
Very interesting.
John. Will you stand up and face people, since almost everybody's behind you?
Because we referred to New Hansen as some numbers and stuff, and put a decade or a meter a decade, I want to be clear that New Hansen's credibility. I'm not speaking for it, but I'm talking about it. No government can afford to.
Yeah.
Well, there's a whole lot of literature that talks about the challenge that we have is that there are clear winners and there are clear losers, and nobody wants to identify the losers. In the U.S., we do often talk about how a lot of the wheat production is going to shift to Canada and out of the northern U.S. plains, and we've already seen some of that. But few people like to envision that they're on the losing end of the stick. But one of the questions I had for particularly David was, you know, when you look at a place like Ladner or you look at South Delta, first of all, there's not a lot of people. I'm going to presume that they're not among the yuppies of the region. And who's going to actually pay for all that protection, or who's going to pay to reinforce and reclaim, because those are not inexpensive operations, and seems like they're a long way away from Ottawa.
Yeah. I don't believe that any of this is happening anyway.
Yeah.
Well, Ottawa's a different matter. The Great Lakes are actually declining due to drought conditions.
So I guess a couple of questions there. First of all, sort of Ladner is, you know, what makes Ladner so special that you would protect that? And, you know, what is the demographic of Ladner? I think Ladner happens to be I think many would consider it a very special place. There's actual historical significance in a place like Ladner. And my guess is that you would only really find the political motivation to protect an area in the middle of nowhere in the agricultural land if there was some kind of community impetus or historical, you know, significance or some kind of community or political movement to do so. Otherwise, it probably just wouldn't ever happen. And who pays for it is the question of the hour. And I think you can see in some of these scenarios, it's possible to find mechanisms to actually offload costs to the individual home and landowners, at least that they would be directly paying for it. And in others, there's probably sort of capital works kinds of programs that would end up being public money, but it's a good question.
One more question, David. If we actually are building those offshore berms, mm-hmm. I'm assuming you're going to be mining that sediment material from someplace. That's going to mm-hmm. really leave Denise's marshes short of the sediment that they need to migrate.
True.
He's got 20 million tons. He's just got to use it wisely.
Okay, so you know, he has an abundance of sediment, so it's not a problem here.
One thing I'll bring up on the payment issue, and this came from a community member. This is the beauty of bringing a whole bunch of people that live and work and are farmers in these places. They have these great ideas. He said, man, he looked at these sort of offshore habitat islands, and he said, wouldn't it be great to have your boat moored out there? You could find some kind of, you know, partnerships, ways of leasing that land. That would be, and I hate to put it in these terms, of like that would be very valuable real estate, right? Mm-hmm. And people would pay to have access to these sort of barrier islands. There's ways of finding funds. There's ways of leasing that land. Like, wouldn't you want to go out there? You know, it's in the middle of Boundary Bay, and you're off on your own little habitat island retreat, and this resident sort of came up with this idea, and I thought, that you're absolutely right. It's a fantastic way to pay for that.
So, Justin, I'm sure I'm not the only person in the room who lives in an elevated house or build-up house. My house, my ground floor elevation is at least 10 feet above the ground. And I live way down the bayou in South Louisiana. But there are a lot of social costs associated with elevating your house. Mm-hmm. Climbing up the stairs as you get old mm-hmm. is a big deal. Elevators is a big deal. Injuries when you have stairs, not a ramp. When your house is 10 feet off the ground or 15, 20 feet off the ground, if you want a wheelchair ramp, it has to be enormously long. Yeah. There are lots of real social issues associated with just going up, and that's not, you know, even if you've got a mound, right? You had in your picture I saw you had some houses kind of on stilts and you had some houses on mounds. Mm-hmm. The higher the mounds get, you know, the more difficult that is. What do you do with a car? What do you do with the vehicles when the water comes? Where do you park? There are lots of issues associated with that when you live in a community that is vulnerable to flooding, well, as ours is, you know, it's. And I just wonder how, if you've been through those conversations with your...
I want to ask you a related question, Denise, and then David. Denise, what do you think about communities that live inside of ring levees and depend upon pumps to keep the water at bay on a regular basis? And how well do those systems work in catastrophic situations?
Well, you know, it's difficult, right? I mean, but there are reasons why. I think this is one of the points that you made at the beginning, or at least in the conversation we've had earlier today. There are reasons why people live in coastal systems, not just because they like to go fishing or boating, but because we have huge ports, right? Those containers don't come off those ships by themselves. We have to have people to work in those systems. We have to have people that support the commerce that is coastally dependent. And so the way our society exists requires some kind of access for population at the coast. And so there's some level of vulnerability that you have to, I think, be able to live with in order to be able to keep some of those functions going.
I think just briefly that what you just brought up actually is a classic trade-off, which is one sort of motivation for us to build pictures of these things, because I didn't get a chance to show all of them. We have all these images. We sort of showed this view on the street of looking up basically into the bottoms of these houses that you've raised up, and we asked people, are these even the kinds of communities that you want to be living in anymore at all? And the trade-off becomes, So, for example, a demographic trade-off. Not everyone can live in a house like that. Even in Kitsilano here, some of the old houses where they didn't have money to dig into the basement. The basement is basically the ground floor. And then you walk up this, you know, this like stairway to heaven up to your house. But, you know, people can do it, but not everyone can do it. So the trade-off would be, okay, if the community decides that demographically it's not going to work, it's an elderly community or what have you, or the character is just not, the sense of place isn't your community anymore, then the trade-off becomes, okay, if the alternative then is hold the line and to just raise the wall and keep the water out, right, keep the water out in the first place, what is the sense of place and character of a community that's behind a wall that's 5 meters tall, right? So then as long as if people understand that there's a trade-off, you're giving up accessibility in favor of the degradation of your sense of place. That's why we make imagery, and that's why we ask people, do you understand the consequences of going down these different avenues? There's trade-offs.
And with that, I think I'm going to close it out because you guys have managed to take a 30-minute discussion session and make it a 50-minute discussion session. Thank you very much for your participation and insights.
Thank you for listening. This concludes the session. For information regarding other sessions in this series, please call AVON at 1-800-810-TAPE.